Hello and welcome to Inside Divorce. My name is Hindell Grossman. I'm a divorce attorney in Massachusetts, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Hubert Johnson, who is a tax attorney. And he's going to explain to us what the difference is between a tax attorney and a CPA, and tell us more about himself and how he can be helpful in the course of a divorce. Hi, Hubert. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, and a pleasure to be here.
Good. Great. Well, tell us a little about yourself first.
Well, I've been doing tax law for about 15 years. I've taught graduate tax law, co-written a couple books on the topic, as well as lectured to tax professionals across the country. I've appeared in a few podcasts. Glad to be here with you, and just recently started a TV show.
A TV show, and you have blogs on the topic, tax topics. What's the TV show about?
How to make tax easy.
Really?
You'll call it How to Make Tax Fun, but I thought that was too big of a stretch.
That would be hard to accomplish. I actually like tax issues. I did well on it in law school, I remember, but not everybody feels that happy about tax.
Ironically, I didn't do well in tax.
Isn't that funny?
Never planned to do it and just kind of fell into it, and I love it.
Yeah, well, you're good at it. So, what can you tell us about being a tax attorney as opposed to a CPA?
So there's all kinds of tax attorneys. There's all different areas of law. Just to try to explain it real quickly, the first part of taxes that everybody's familiar with is filing your taxes. April 15th, we all know we have to do it every single year. A lot of people will get an extension. So you have tax preparers and CPAs that do most of that work. Some tax attorneys choose to file taxes. We do not. We prefer to refer that out and focus on what we do best. We do some audit work, but a lot of CPAs do that work as well. If it gets too complicated or there's more negotiations needed, that's where we come in. But we really focus on dealing with how much actually has to be paid to IRS and state taxes. So even though you owe a tax, doesn't mean you have to pay it. And so that's where we really come in to set up the resolution that works best for the clients. We save businesses, we wipe out balances, or set up something that works for them. And we review all of their options and help them out in that manner. We deal with the bank levies, wage garnishments. You've all heard the radio ads about that. And so
right.
We dive in there and tackle issues head on that are hurting taxpayers the most.
So you tax attorneys are the guys that are friendly with the IRS and your State Department of Revenue to try to work with them to get them happy to get payments made and make clients happy by maybe paying less.
Usually we're friendly.
Yeah.
again, honey runs people over better than vinegar, but there's times where we absolutely get a little testy. We put a foot down and say, look, you're violating my client's rights.
Mm-hmm.
And, as long as we're getting what we want, we're sweet as pie. But just like any area of law, you've got to stand up for your client when their rights are being trampled.
So I don't know what rights we have. I feel like taxpayers feel like they have no rights. They just have to pay. So what rights do taxpayers have?
Well, you absolutely have due process rights. So yeah. The IRS has to go and follow a particular pattern, which makes it easy to predict where a case is going once you get an idea of where it is. We can absolutely help that to taxpayers' advantage. Believe it or not, most IRS debt and even state debt becomes unenforceable after a period of 10 years with the IRS and usually 20 years with the states. So we help people all the time if they're close to that 10-year expiration date. They get past that, the IRS can't collect. They'll always take your money, but they can't do anything to take the money.
I see. So 10 years for the IRS, it's kind of the statute of limitations.
Correct. It's called the CSED collection statute expiration date, but it functions similarly. It can be told if you file an offer and compromise or a bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So it can get stretched out beyond the 10 years, but in practice, it's usually about 10 years.
Okay, so 10 years for the IRS and 20 years for the state. Do you happen to know, you're not in Massachusetts, but Massachusetts length of time, do you happen to know?
It's the rule of thumb is 20 years. Now, every state is different. And yes, we have worked with Massachusetts. In big cases, the states can file and extend that year, that out to 30 years, but they have to file another tax lien to do that. They usually don't do it unless it's a larger case, but the states are all different. California, if you set up the wrong thing and you set up an installment agreement that fails, they'll restart the 20 years.
Wow. Is it fair to say that some states are tougher than the IRS in tax enforcement?
Some?
No, most? By the look on your face, most?
Most states are much worse than the IRS. It's, we're in Arizona, so we even have, not far from me, we have Tombstone, which most people know as the site of the shootout at the OK Corral. That's been in movies and stuff. Dealing with states is like the Wild West.
Oh, yes.
Well-defined rules. You get what you can. You can climb the chain. You can deal with managers. But, for example, here in Arizona, they have an offer and compromise program. And we have people that should qualify for it. And we submitted offers for them. They've come back and told us, we just don't like to do offers.
Oh, despite the program for that purpose.
The program. Uh-huh. Now, each state is different. We get quite a few offer and compromises through with New York. Sometimes it's easier to get an offer and compromise through with New York than the IRS. Hmm. California has a horrible offer and compromise program. So California is one of the tougher states to deal with. Each state is different.
But
the IRS has well-defined rules. And so it's a lot easier to predict what they're going to do and get a lot more done with them because they have an internal revenue manual. If they're not following it, we can cite it to them. We print it out. And sometimes I fax it to them to say, you're wrong. This is why.
Oh, interesting. So who qualifies for an offer and compromise?
It depends on the particular facts. So your favorite attorney answer, it depends.
Right.
I use the analogy of Cinderella's slipper. If it fits, it's amazing. We do offers for as low as $20. We had an offer recently where someone owed over $240,000 and we settled it for $20.
How did you do that?
It's just their rules, their financial analysis, and we use it to the advantage of our taxpayers.
That's remarkable.
Higher, we just had one recently accepted where it was $5,000 on, I think, $120,000 in debt.
Yeah.
Still a great offer. But they had some assets. They had some other issues. So you have to look at their assets and their income to expense. And it's laid out the rules. As long as you understand the rules, you can really help it. Doesn't mean you can't have any assets. We have people with retirements that are retired can have $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 in assets and still qualify. So it depends.
All right. So is there certain assets that don't exempt you from a compromise? Like a retirement asset, which assets are most vulnerable or more meaningful in your negotiations?
So if you have too much equity in real property, that could be a problem. If you have second homes, if you have too much in cash, savings, invested in the market, Bitcoin assets, the IRS treats those all as you can liquidate them and pay towards your tax debt. So they're not very patient with those kinds of assets.
So the example you gave of someone owing $240,000 to the IRS that you settled for $20,000. Did you say $20,000 or $20?
$20.
That is unbelievable. So what were their financial circumstances that you were so successful? You remember? They probably didn't have much real estate.
And I have staff. I have other attorneys that handle a lot of the casework. But doing $20 offers is something that we do regularly. And for example, I had someone who unemployed in New York. The original liability wasn't even his fault. He worked with somebody and his boss told him, hey, sign these things and made him liable for a lot of payroll issues for the business. So when the business closed out, New York and the IRS went after him.
Wow.
And it's really kind of a sad situation. He was living on the streets of New York through COVID with the teenage son. And in a hotel room at least, so he was off the streets. But we did an offer and compromise for $20 with the IRS and wiped out about $100,000 of the liability. And then turned around and did a similar offer with the state of New York, but it was $10,000 with New York. But he got his former boss to pay that amount.
Oh, what a story. So in your work, do you look at whether first, I guess the first thing you might look at is whether that amount is owed that the person thinks that they might owe because their CPA did a tax return and that's what the number showed on the tax return. Do you first look at that to see if that was done correctly?
We definitely look into that. Good story. We had a gal, and not to knock anybody, but this gal sold a house in, I think it was Ohio, moved down to Tucson, snowbirds, moved down to Arizona, bought a home, and she, in her words, used a program cheaper than TurboTax to file her tax return.
Okay.
The IRS sent her a notice that she owed $130,000 in taxes, and this is a gal retiring on Social Security, and she just hoped to have a house, you know, without rent or without a mortgage to retire comfortably. She freaked out, called us. We looked at it and said, look, did you claim the personal deduction, you know, sale of a home of $250,000? No. Did she report that she had a mortgage on the home of about $150,000? She sold the home for around $300,000.
Yeah.
And it all showed us profit.
I see.
So we told her, look, we could do an offer and compromise, but why? We referred her to a local CPA. He amended the tax return and she ended up not owing a penny.
Right. So people are foolish sometimes about how they go about filing their tax returns or preparing their own.
I wouldn't say foolish, uninformed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is, one of the smartest things I had said to me was by a gentleman from the South. And he said, look, I'm not very educated. I don't know what I'm doing. So I called you. Mm-hmm. I said, that's one of the smartest things I've heard.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I don't do my own plumbing. Well, I have. And then I've had to pay more for the plumber to come. We've all done that, right?
We have.
Yeah. So you call an expert, get expert advice, and you know,
it could save you money.
It saves you so much money. I had one guy call. He was excited because he decided to get right with the IRS, and he went and filed 23 years of tax returns going back to 1996.
Yeah.
He's getting straight. He
Crazy.
Only had to file the last 6 years.
Oh,
so
wow.
Filed 17 years of tax returns. That 10-year time window started running when he filed it, which was in 2019.
Yeah.
So that debt from 96 won't go away until 29 at the soonest.
Oh, right. So he did a disservice to himself, didn't he? Wasn't well informed.
Well, that's why I tell people, get some good advice first. We don't charge for a consultation, and there's plenty of times where we give out free advice. It shouldn't cost someone an arm and a leg just to get steered in the right direction.
Mm. Good idea. So relating what you do to divorce work, I do have a case actually at the moment where the party sold the vacation home and has some pretty substantial capital gains on that sale that we're discussing in the context of a divorce settlement. But what do you do? How do you advise couples who are divorcing on filing separately or jointly with respect to exposure?
It all depends if the back taxes come into play, have taxes accumulated throughout the marriage. So the number one thing to remember in divorce, and you said it yourself, you're trying to figure out the best way to settle this equitably in a marriage settlement agreement or divorce decree. The IRS does not care what's in the settlement, the MSA or the divorce decree.
Yeah.
You can make all the agreements you want with the other party. The IRS doesn't care. If you filed that tax return jointly, mm-hmm. they're going to go after both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually going to go after the person that's more responsible and takes care of their money. And because money is the number one reason or one of the biggest reasons why people get divorced, usually there's one party that's irresponsible. So a lot of times I see tax debt being split 50-50. You both handle half. IRS doesn't care. They're not going to respect that. They're going to go after whoever is more responsible, has more assets, and try to get the full amount.
So essentially, that document that the spouses sign to get a divorce and they negotiate the terms, and if one of the terms is that they split the IRS debt or the state debt, the IRS doesn't care what it says in that document. It's going to be whoever the IRS or the state decides to pursue. And you can't even, no indemnification language in that document will help.
Not with the IRS or the state. And their policy is that if your spouse owes you, go pursue them. And how well does that work out?
Mm-hmm.
Not very well.
Crazy.
Most of the time.
So there's really no way of negotiating around that.
Well, I would, and this is what I suggest to divorce attorneys all the time. If you have the more responsible party, protect them. It makes more sense for them to assume responsibility for the tax debt if they're the ones that it's probably going to fall on anyway, and then get other assets to compensate them for that.
Okay. So it's an unequal division of the assets because one of the spouses should take on 100% of the debt to make sure it's paid.
Well, and if you're the more responsible person, I would do that.
Yeah.
But again, sometimes both parties are responsible, but you've got to understand that the IRS is going to look to whatever party, and if someone becomes unemployed
yeah.
or their income goes down and then they can't shoulder that burden, it's going to fall on the other party.
Understood. So any other suggestions about how parties, when married or when divorcing, should handle their tax obligations?
Well, that goes right to what you asked me first regarding married filing separately or married filing joint. If you yeah. know that your partner is bad with their money or is going to owe taxes, there's nothing stopping you from doing married filing separate. It isn't as advantageous as married filing joint or filing married filing joint, but if you don't want to get embroiled in your partner's tax issues,
mm-hmm.
it will save you so much headache.
Yeah.
It's on them to deal with it, and you don't have to worry about it. Now, part of the problem that we see a lot is a lot of this is hidden from the other partner. They
yeah.
don't know about it. And it's really hard to get what's called an innocent spouse application approved.
Yeah.
You essentially yeah. had to have not known about the income and not benefited from it or had Ooh. Reason to know about it.
Yeah. Both of which are going to be hard to prove. If the income benefited the family, probably benefited the innocent spouse too, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. which is hard. But if someone is essentially embezzling from the money from the family, they're sending it to a girlfriend or they are hiding the money from them and they never saw the money, then you have
yeah.
a good application. That is the exception, though. And a lot of people think, hey, let's file for an innocent spouse. It's much easier to go in there, especially if you have a spouse, you know, they get divorced. Unfortunately, a lot of times the women have fewer assets, fewer income, but they also become ideal candidates oftentimes for an offer and compromise to settle it, wipe it out. And it always follows your Social Security number. So if the wife wipes it out under her Social Security, she
yeah.
no longer has any responsibility for it.
Mm.
The IRS will still pursue the other party for the full amount. And they'll have to negotiate their own resolution.
I see. Well, these are important things to know because that tax debt can really follow you even after you get divorced. Right?
Absolutely.
Does bankruptcy help?
It can. It absolutely can. The rule of thumb that is tax debt needs to be at least 3 years old before it can be settled in bankruptcy. If you just need to buy some time and you have a bunch of other pressing debts that need to be addressed, you can always file for bankruptcy and the IRS cannot pursue it all while you're going through a bankruptcy, but it also extends out that 10 years because they can't legally pursue you for it. It extends out how long they can come after you for it. So if you're considering bankruptcy, talk to a local bankruptcy attorney because every bankruptcy district in the entire country is a little different.
Oh.
They have different allowable amounts for cash on hand for what's allowable in a house. And so that's why I highly recommend if you are considering that, talk to a bankruptcy attorney, see what needs to happen. I have plenty of people that come to me with tax debt. They have medical debt. They have, you know, credit card loans. If they have enough other debt where it makes more sense to go file for bankruptcy, I refer them to a bankruptcy attorney.
I understand. So you say they have the tax debt has to be at least three years old to file bankruptcy. But then
that's
what?
The rule of thumb.
Okay, so what's the relationship between that 3 years and the 10 years that the IRS has to go after you?
So the IRS had to have had an opportunity to pursue it for 3 years. Now, each district is different. I believe in Arizona, there's a 240-day rule or something like that. So that's why I said check with your local bankruptcy attorney.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The 3 years doesn't affect the 10 years, that the 10 years continues to run until a bankruptcy is actually filed, then it extends it up. But the general rule of thumb is that diarists needed to have an opportunity to pursue it for 3 years. And if it's still there, then it is eligible for bankruptcy.
In other words, so the taxing authorities have 3 years to pursue their claim and collect the debt. And if they were if those entities were unsuccessful, then a person can file bankruptcy to eliminate the tax obligations.
Now, I have seen where people file for bankruptcy and they have some years that qualify and some years that don't. Mm. You just need to be aware that when the bankruptcy is completed,
yeah,
you need to address those years that weren't discharged in bankruptcy.
Yeah, I get it. Complicated, like so many legal things, right?
Interesting and fun.
Yeah, every case is different, is that right? Okay,
yeah,
well, actually, very encouraging. It seems like offers in compromise were something for, you know, that not that many people would qualify for, but it sounds like, you know, with good tax advice from a tax attorney like you, more people could potentially qualify or get some sort of tax benefits they didn't realize existed or that they were
Absolutely.
Eligible for.
Mm-hmm. I have an interesting case I can share real quick where this family called up, and it was a referral through one of our referral partners, a financial planner. And he called me up, and he didn't want to call me up, but his parents knew the financial advisor and they said, you needed to call this tax guy. And he told me he had talked to a couple other attorneys. They all told him he didn't qualify for an offer in compromise. He went on the IRS website, didn't believe he qualified. So when he first called, he said, I don't know what you're going to do. I said, well, let me walk through it. I went through his financial analysis and I told him, look, right now you don't qualify.
Yeah.
For a couple of reasons. Main reason, he had $40,000 sitting in a 401k. He was in his 30s, nowhere close to retirement.
Yeah.
He also, it showed that he had equity in his home.
Yeah.
Zillow showed it at $600,000.
Nope.
So I asked him some details here. Okay, what's going on here? Tell me about your home. It was built in the 1880s.
Yeah.
Last updated around World War II.
Yeah.
What kind of shape do you think this house was in?
Probably needed an update.
It still had lead piping
yeah.
in the house, and we had two young kids.
Okay.
So I suggested to them, maybe we take the 401k money, cash that out, use that for necessary repairs in the home, replace the lead piping. I was like, what else needs to be done? It's like, oh, the kitchen. I mean, the list of repairs was long for this mm-hmm. old home.
Yeah.
And we got an appraisal because the IRS will follow Zillow. They like it because it tends to be high. But we got a separate appraisal on the home, which came in at much lower. So it showed there wasn't equity in the home. We used the 401k for something that was necessary. Don't take it to Vegas. People have done it.
Uh-huh.
It's not a good idea. True story. But we were able to get him an offer and compromise for him and his wife for around $5,000 to settle around $80,000.
Brilliant.
So
you asked a lot of questions. You asked different questions.
You have to be a little creative. You have to know what will work, won't work, what won't work. Believe it or not, if you repair your driveway, that's not considered a necessary repair.
Mm.
You fix your roof, you replace a leaky kitchen. But if you go in and deck out your kitchen with brand new things just to spend money, no. If you repair a pool, no, that's not allowable.
Right.
So it really depends on what the IRS will allow and what they won't, and knowing those rules. So a lot of offers get rejected because people don't understand the rules. And that applies to taxpayers. I had one case. It was submitted for $20. No, it was submitted for $0.
Yeah.
This gal had hired this guy. They submitted the offer and it got rejected. It says on the form, you cannot submit a $0 offer. I put $20, submitted it, didn't change anything else, and it got accepted.
Oh, remarkable.
I was like, go ask for the money back from that other guy, because he just didn't know what he was doing.
Goes to show you that expertise is worth it. When you have expert advice that's useful, you know, it can really save you a lot of money and help you make good decisions. Well, Hubert, it's been wonderful speaking to you. Thank you. I've learned a lot today. I hope our listeners have too. Well, please give us your contact information so people can maybe watch your show or read your blog or call you directly.
So the best way to find me is to look up Guardian Tax Law. It's Guardian Tax Law PLLC. Our website is guardiantaxlaw.com. And we're going to be posting those shows, you know, like I just started this morning, but I'll be doing that. And we're going to be setting up so people can call in and ask me questions. And you can call us directly. Our main line is 520-485-7371. You'll get to talk to a tax attorney that will go through the whole case with you and give you a good idea of what your rights and options are. And you have plenty of rights and options.
And your firm handles taxpayers from all over the country.
Right. All over the country. We even do some foreign account work, and we help with SBA loan defaults as well.
Fabulous. Well, thank you for your time. Appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.
It's been a pleasure.